This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 12th of August 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, Russian and NATO military forces have stepped up their training exercises, but a new report by an influential think tank suggests that their training for the worst-case scenario, full-blown war, isn't impossible. I'll be discussing that with my guests Raffaello Pantucci and James Boyes. Then, a pair of Mississippi newlyweds have been caught trying to join ISIS. We'll explore the root causes of homegrown radicalization and discuss whether there's anything that anyone can do about it. Meanwhile, the violence in Iraq and Syria has spilled over into America's presidential debates. With accusations flying across party lines, we'll ask whether red or blue is more to blame for the region's chaos. And later on, the success of one contender for the Oval Office has surprised even the most open-minded of pollsters. But can the big crowds for Bernie Sanders translate into big votes? And can he displace Hillary for the Democratic nod? All those stories and more on Midori House. So welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Raffaello Pantucci, Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute, and James Boyes, a regular Monocle 24 contributor and political historian. James and Raffaello, welcome to you both. In a moment, we'll be looking at ISIS, radicalisation, and America's presidential campaign. But I'd like to start today's discussion with a story that could have been pulled from the newspapers in 1985. The big question: can the Cold War between Moscow and the West ever turn hot? And if so, when? A new report from the European Leadership Network, a group made up of ex-foreign and defence ministers, policymakers and generals, suggests that Russian and NATO forces have both abandoned hypothetical enemies in their respective war games and are now fully training for large-scale war with each other. James Boyes, is this just a case of war games becoming, the more that they're talked about, that the more that the other side gets slightly excited slash scared and increases their own war games?
It's possible. I think that if you look at the history of what's been going on between Russia and the West and NATO over the last 20 years or so, it's really a shame, actually, because, you know, there've been so many great hopes. You know, when Clinton was president, you know, NATO expansion, for example, we instigated the Partnership for Peace, very much to try to make it seem that NATO was not just being geared up against Russia. Russia came in very much as a partner in many respects. And what you've seen, instead of a natural progression towards things getting better, things have obviously gotten a lot worse of late, with Putin coming in and a sense that there's a retrenchment going on here. But this idea of war games and things getting out of control, you know, it's nothing particularly new, and I'm sure we can discuss this, but, you know, you go back to the, I think, 1980s and something like Operation Able Archer, for example, which was a war game which very, very nearly got taken out of control because people couldn't tell whether it was real or whether it was imaginary. When you have that many troops in such a close proximity, you know, the risk of an accidental start of something which can't be pulled back from becomes ever real.
And that's the thing, isn't it, Raffaello, with these war games in particular, is that normally when countries or military alliances carry them out, there's a hypothetical enemy somewhere and, oh, no, we don't worry, Vlad, we definitely weren't talking about you. And yet, in this case, both with Russia and with NATO exercises recently, it has been very clear who the proposed enemy is.
Yeah, and I mean, we've seen this in lots of other contexts as well. If you look in Asia, you know, the British Marines were recently helping the Japanese do a training exercise, which looked an awful lot like trying to take back some small islands that were off your periphery that may have not been invaded by a neighbouring country. So, I mean, it's pretty standard practice in some ways, but I think the point with the Russia and NATO side here, and in some ways this is something this report was really highlighting, is this fact that have we really got a good understanding of what the other side is really doing and what buttons they're trying to push? And that danger of miscalculation, I think, is the real key here and one of the things they're trying to highlight. And the reality is that during the Cold War, they developed structures through which NATO and Russia could communicate what was kind of going on. And that helped sort of defuse tensions a little bit and mean that you could do these sorts of things in a slightly less provocative way. I think the point is that we lost those structures. They're not really in place anymore. And now we're dealing with a very sort of difficult situation and a situation where, frankly, Russia has been sending forces into neighboring countries and is supporting conflicts that are happening in neighboring countries. And this is making others very nervous.
In a sense, James, isn't this what militaries should be doing?
Yeah.
They should be preparing for the worst. They should be in a position where they know what's going to come.
There's no doubt about that. I think one of the problems you have here is it's all well and good having a war game exercise. The problem we seem to be having at the moment is that they're having war game exercises at the same time in close proximity. It's one thing saying we're going to have one over here and one over here or at different time periods, but when these operations are happening concurrently and you're putting aircraft, naval vessels and armed forces in a very, very close proximity, it doesn't take a genius to figure out how an accident could spark something which could lead to something which nobody wants, unwarranted, unexpected. We were talking about war game exercises at the height, just before the Cuban Missile Crisis, around that time period, the Bay of Pigs. The United States launched an operation against a dictator in the Caribbean, fictional, called Ortsak, which nobody had to guess was actually Castro backwards.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned the Bay of Pigs there and war games exercises, because often it seems that even if they are practiced, Raffaello, they don't necessarily then work. I mean, the US knew for a long time it was going to be going into Iraq. I mean, it had been in Iraq 12 years beforehand, so it knew the terrain pretty well. That didn't. They didn't seem to know what they were doing there, did they?
Well, they did know in terms of going in. They kicked the door down pretty effectively. It was tidying up afterwards and trying the sort of post-conflict reconstruction phase that I don't think anyone prepared for, and I don't think they have, frankly, now again. But I mean, that's, you know, the problem is that when you're telling a military to prepare for a war, they'll prepare for the kinetic conflict that stands in front of them, the confrontation they'll have to do. The sort of subsequent side of it, that's not really their issue, you know. We're there to stomp in and do that. And I mean, these training exercises are, I mean, in many ways, there is much about building confidence in some of the border countries between Europe. Some of the European countries that border Russia, frankly, you know, some of the ones on the eastern side. It's really as much about NATO saying to those countries, you know, we are standing with you, and should Article 5, the famous article of the NATO constitution that mandates that, you know, an attack on any one member is an attack on the lot, so everyone will respond together, will actually get triggered in response. Because there's been a lot of questions about that. If you look at Ukraine and you look at Georgia, where Russia clearly sort of went in and used military forces against these countries, there was a question about, well, does that show that NATO is not really resolute in supporting their allies? And so
Ukraine and Georgia aren't.
Well, they weren't. You see, that's the thing. They were close, though. They were Partnership for Peace members. They'd done a lot of training with them. But I agree with you. There is a difference there. But I think that difference is something that isn't necessarily felt if you go to the Baltic capitals or even if you go to Poland.
Well, and indeed, and James, I imagine one part of these war games for NATO themselves is also to show those Baltic states and perhaps even, you know, countries like Poland as well, that don't worry, we really do have your back if the worst thing happens.
You're absolutely right, and the idea that Article 5 would trigger an automatic response is something which has been, you know, ingrained into why these nations wanted to join NATO in the first place. The irony, of course, is that Article 5, you would think, was there to protect the least defended nations, the weakest nations. The only time Article 5 has ever been invoked was after 9/11 attack on the United States.
And the US rejected all support subsequently in their Operation Afghanistan. So we don't need your help, we got this one. Yeah?
Exactly. So it's a bizarre clause which has great ideological power, but in terms of its actual implementation is not far off worthless.
We're going to stick on this topic somewhat and ask this question. Who is America's scariest foe on the global stage? It's a question that is often tossed around in Washington, but the current strategic calculus has apparently never been cloudier. At various different executive agencies and the White House all seem to disagree on what country or group currently makes up the most complex and dangerous security threat. The Pentagon say it's Russia. Barack Obama says it's generally in the Middle East and North Africa. The FBI are saying it's ISIS. James, does it matter? Do you need, you know, does a country necessarily need to have, you know, a number one enemy? Or is it actually just, this shows more realistically what's happening in the world today, that actually there are a number of different threats, and depending on the day of the week and what's happening elsewhere, each one of them could be the main one?
I think what it does demonstrate, Steve, is the idea that each executive agency within the United States has its own different mandate. They all focus upon slightly different things. So the United States, the Pentagon, for example, is going to have a very different sort of matrix about how it will determine threat levels and threat perceptions than the FBI, who of course are a domestic law enforcement agency. The CIA will have a different take on it. What you would hope is that someone at the top of all this, i.e. the president and national security advisor, is bringing all these ideas together, filtering them, and saying, right, this is where we need to focus the attention of the United States government. I think if there is a criticism of this administration, is perhaps that isn't happening quite as vigorously as it could be.
Rafael, it's interesting looking at the Pentagon's list. This was General Joseph Dunford, who put Russia at the top as a number one existential threat. Russia then followed by North Korea, and pipping ISIS to the third spot is China.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think it's exactly what James talking about. If you're looking at what is it that the Pentagon sort of looks at as the main confrontation threats that it's looking at, it sees Russia as a big country that's an enemy. It sees China as a big country that's an enemy. And it sees North Korea as a kind of odd country that seems to be getting big country weapons. ISIS remains a group of guys fighting in the Levant who maybe are posing a sort of terrorist threat in the broader region and are maybe sending out cells or individuals or trying to instigate people to launch attacks. But it's not really the same kind of a substantial kinetic threat that that you could look at a country like Russia and say that really could be, you know, a confrontation with Russia could end in nuclear conflict, which, yes, one could say is an existential threat.
And in some ways, Rafael, do you think that's more sensible for the Pentagon to look at it in that way and say, you know, look, ISIS might get headlines, and obviously what they're doing in that region is appalling, but when we look at it through the very narrow lens of which group, which nation, which entity is the biggest threat to the United States, they're not near the top of the list.
I would agree with it 100%. And I think the Prime Minister here in the UK, David Cameron, said that, you know, ISIS was an existential threat, which I think is just a completely ridiculous thing to say, because you're comparing an organization that is, you know, running around the Levant building this sort of proto-Islamist state that is doing these, frankly, small-scale threat things that are very noisy and attract a lot of attention, but are not really the sort of threat which is going to make London disappear. You know, I mean, it's a very different sort of scale. Whereas if you look at a country like China or Russia, for example, you know, these are countries that have the sorts of weaponry and have the sorts of potential to really launch an attack which could wipe us off the face of the earth and is therefore an existential threat. So I think it's a much more kind of reasoned list, a much more sensible list to be seeing. In some ways, what's interesting to me is if you go back and look not that long ago, I think that the DOD would have put China top of that list rather than Russia. If you go back and look
and
at
why do you
of,
think that's changed?
Well, I think that's changed partially because the sort of relationship with Russia has gotten so negative and gotten so bad, and there was always a sense that China was the great power that the US was going to have to confront, and there was a fear around Taiwan and the fact that the Taiwanese might decide to go in a direction that would mean that the Chinese would decide to invade the island, and they have a congressional Taiwan Relations Act, which congressionally mandates the US will defend any attack on Taiwanese democracy, and so that might lead them into a direct confrontation with the Chinese. And there are lots of other sort of treaties that the Americans have across the sort of South China Seas that could potentially drag them into that sort of a threat. I think the perception is that the relationship with China has now changed and has now been developed in a direction that means that there is more of a conversation happening there, which means that the sort of conflict which escalates into that sort of a threat is maybe more distant than the situation with Russia.
It's interesting, James. I mean, we started this conversation talking about war games, sure, and sort of rival war games with NATO and with Russia. And yet even there, it's a bit of a stretch to imagine an actual war between NATO and Russia. You can imagine skirmishes. You can imagine, you know, 300 little green men showing up out of a forest in Estonia, mm-hmm, and causing something there. But in terms of when we look at this, you know, this list from the Pentagon, it's, you know, Russia, it's North Korea, it's China. It's even with those countries, and yes, as Rafael says, mm-hmm, they have the potential, they have the ability to to launch all sorts of attacks. Sure. But, you know, I know we talk about how dangerous the world is right now, but actually, does this suggest that things aren't that bad after all?
I think one of the slight issues I would take with your question is the very beginning of it, which is the idea that it's unimaginable. Yeah. It's like, yeah, but everything isn't until it happens and it becomes inevitable. I think most people before the First World War would have said, well, it's never going to escalate. It's going to last a couple of months and that'll be it and we'll be home for Christmas. These things have a life of their own. You know, you go back to, again, I'll raise the issue with the Cuban Missile Crisis again. You know, President Kennedy was very, very concerned about the idea that just one little accident, somebody not following the chain of command, doing something that's not intentional. No one is saying the Kremlin or the White House wants war. But sometimes you start putting people together, accidents happen, and it can lead to something which is unimaginable.
And I think we're not beyond the age of limited conflicts. You know, you just need to look at the war in Georgia and the look in Russia. I think there's a perception that if the West was to confront Russia, this would be a nuclear strike, bombs. Mm. Well, no, I think the reality is that history has shown us, recent history has shown us that actually we can find ourselves facing off against these countries in a much more limited fashion.
Okay, let's now turn our attention to ISIS. Two young newlyweds from Mississippi have been accused of attempting to travel to Syria to join up with ISIS fighters. The pair, a 19 and 22-year-old, were arrested on Saturday while en route to the airport. Rafaela, you've just written a book about radicalisation here in the UK called We Love Death As You Love Life. Do you think the same root causes of violent radicalisation that you've studied in the UK apply to parts of America too?
Yeah, I think is the short answer. And I think the difficulty is that there is no single path to radicalization. It's an individual process. Individuals decide that they've adopted these ideas and decide to go down these paths. I was actually reading the affidavit that came out that was associated with this case. And what's really interesting about it is because it all draws from their conversations with people who they thought were ISIS recruiters and radicalizers online, but in fact were FBI agents who were trolling the internet for people like this to go after. And it's really interesting because actually in the sort of correspondence you see, they're really interested in trying to understand what this state is. And they want to go participate in the state. And they say, well, I can go there and I can be a media mujahid. I want to go participate in that side of it. And the girl says, I have some nursing training. I can come and help in that way. And they're really drawn by this whole narrative of going to build and construct the state. And I think that's a really interesting aspect, which we really should be careful to kind of miss when we focus a lot on when we talk about ISIS. We see this horrible group that's, you know, decapitating.
And it's about their hatred for
exactly.
us
and
rather than looking
more
at, well, there's an ideology here which, you know, we may not agree with, but that's what's drawing people in.
It really is. It's about building this utopian society, and it is apparently attracting a lot of these people. The other aspect, I think, if you're going to look at a sort of difference between what happens in the US and what happens here in the UK, for example, is that in the UK, and this is something that's changed over time, is it tends to be grouped in places and clustered around people. And we tend to see there's a substantial human dynamic as well, a sort of an online component. Whereas in the States, it's much more scattered around. And so we've seen lots of these cases in just really random places in the US. And that's much more about individuals being quite isolated. And
is that also, so just on that point, is that also because so much of the recruitment can be done online now that you don't need, you know, a very sort of powerful, influential local figure who can persuade people?
Partially. I mean, I'm very careful of going too far down this path because we start to go down the path of saying that people just sit at their computer and radicalize. And usually when you dig into the cases, there's some contact with the real world as well. But I think certainly it has accelerated that process.
James, as tragic as these cases are for the individuals concerned and for their families and friends, we live, you know, in the West in free societies, in democracies. People, you know, should be free to do what they want to do within reason. Does this really matter quite as much as the media often make it out?
It's fascinating. I think this story is so nicely linked in with the story we were just talking about in terms of, you know, where threat levels are perceived to be coming from. I mean, clearly these two individuals are no threat that the Pentagon would worry about, but this is why the FBI worried about this, because the idea of people going over there, getting radicalized, and then coming back, and this idea of, you know, the lone wolf, the individual terrorist within the society, you know, the enemy within, effectively. Of course, in the United States, they have First Amendment rights, so they can type whatever they want to a certain extent. But of course, you know, this idea that, you know, if they are going overseas to join an organization which is a direct threat to the United States, then the legal authorities are going to take responsibility for that. If they don't, of course, then there'll be questions asked about, well, you know, what happens when these people go over there, come back? I think a greater question is, and we were talking there about why these people are doing it, what the rationale for it is how accurate their aspirations are. I mean, if this young lady wants to go over there and become a nurse, for example, are ISIS recruiting for nurses these days? Is that how they see the role of women, for example, when they get over there? You know, are they deluding themselves into thinking that, you know, hey, this is lovely, we can go over there and lead a new lifestyle over there and be accepted?
Rafael, just on this security question, you know, it's often said when it's talked about as actually, you know, this is a real security threat when young people go from Western countries to Syria or Iraq to join ISIS because, well, they might come back here. Now, as you've just said, one of this couple wants to do media work. The other one wants to be a nurse. Now, we may end up being horrendously wrong on this, but one suspects if they did come back, if they're just going to do a bit of PR or still do nursing and talk about how great ISIS are, that's not a huge threat to America.
No, it's not. But I mean, the issue becomes that if you look at historical conflicts and foreign fighter flows to historical conflicts with a sort of Islamist bent to them, and the archetypal example of this is the 7-7 plot, where you had Muhammad Sadiq Khan, who'd been back and forth to training camps in Pakistan 3 or 4 times. He was initially drawn by the fight in Kashmir and trying to go participate and support the unfortunate Kashmiri people against the evil Indian government. And then from there, you see that he sort of, through the connections and links he developed, he ended up connecting with a group that was more in Afghanistan. And then when he went out to in the first instance, his plan was to go and die in Afghanistan. And we know this because of videos that emerged afterwards in which he was saying goodbye to his daughter. But when he was out there, he met people with Al-Qaeda who were affiliated with Al-Qaeda, who said to him, you know, if you really want to make a difference, you should go back home. And I think that's the key problem, is that some of these individuals are very impressionable young people who may be persuaded once they're out there, you're here now, you're participating in the cause. If you really want to make a difference, what you should do is go and do something else. And that's really where I think the sort of threat, the threat concern lies in terms of them coming back.
James, we've been watching with great interest and glee the American presidential campaign. It's been great fun to watch, particularly.
And we're still 2 years out, aren't we? I mean,
I think it's always election time. It's always election time, America. But what's been striking is how large a role foreign policy has played so far, certainly within the Republican debate. Whether that actually will have a big impact on how people vote, we'll see. Mm-hmm. But obviously, the shadow of Iraq looms large. Mm-hmm. And we've now seen Jeb Bush this week, who has sort of struggled with this issue of Iraq, of what to say. He sort of stumbled over whether he agreed with it in the first place, or now he says he's not quite sure he would have voted for it if it had been him. And, well, it was quite complicated. But he's now tried to shift the blame for what's happening in Iraq now to another president. He's tried to pin the blame on Barack Obama, and of course Hillary Clinton as Secretary of State in Obama's first term. How successful is that likely to be for him?
It's an uphill battle, isn't it? There was a lovely line that came out of the Clinton campaign. It basically said, look, if you're looking for people to blame for the Iraq scenario, you know, look around the next family gathering of the Bush family, effectively. Yeah. It's a great, great line. Jeb Bush is in all sorts of trouble. I mean, you were saying he was stumbling over this and stumbling over that. He's stumbling full stop. I mean, the guy seems not to be able to make a coherent sentence at this point. Jeb Bush should be out in front by a country mile, quite frankly, at this point. The fact that he isn't speaks volumes to the fact, I think, that the Republican Party do not want him to be their nominee. The fact that Donald Trump is out there making outrageous remarks and getting ahead in the polls is indicative of that as well. Jeb Bush is not going to be able to shake off the family mantra. His name is Bush, no matter about the fact that in the debate he said, oh, well, they call me Jeb in Florida. I think they call him Jeb. That is his assumed name. I think they call him that everywhere, quite frankly. So you can't get around the fact that his surname is Bush, and he wouldn't be where he is now if it wasn't, quite frankly. So you can't have it both ways, Jeb. So this idea of him trying to push it onto Hillary is a non-starter. Clearly trying to say, oh, it's all about ISIS. The big problem that Hillary's got from a foreign policy point of view from the Republicans is actually more about Libya and Benghazi. And they're going to keep trying to thrash that, I think. I don't think she's going to get very well for it myself.
That seems to be one of those issues that a certain type of Republican thinks is incredibly important, but most other people are like, oh yeah, I remember vaguely something
Absolutely.
About that.
And the tragedy in this, to be fair, is that, you know, people died and the United States Senator was killed, ambassador was killed, the first since 1979. There's no doubt about it that it was a tragic scenario. Hillary Clinton's responsibility for it, I think, is very, very doubtful. If not, actually non-existent.
Raffaello, when we look at the role Iraq and particularly ISIS is going to play in the presidential election, you know, talking to people who work on Syria at the moment, they feel that basically nothing is going to happen until there's someone new in the White House. There'll be no change of strategy, which means that for the next 15, 18 months, we're in a kind of stasis. We're kind of in a bit of a limbo, waiting to see what may or may not happen.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty much it. I can't see it. There's been no strategic decisions that have been made out of Washington, in London or in Paris or in other capitals. They may try to, but they can't. They don't really have the oomph to push them through in a sort of strategic change on the ground. The problem is that Syria is just such a thorny situation that it's kind of like, which direction do you go in? You know, do you start supporting the Assad regime on the conclusion that they're the ones who can maybe counter ISIS? Do you start supporting Jabhat al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's group on the ground because they're rebels fighting against ISIS and also against the regime? Do you start supporting ISIS, which is what some people seem to believe, which is something we're trying? It's just like there's this vortex of confusion. I think it reflects the fact that there has been no real strategic decision made because, frankly, no one really knows what to do. You know, and I really think the situation at this point is a sort of management one. And I don't even necessarily know that if we had a different and more decisive government in Washington, that we would necessarily be able to see the sort of see what would really change. What they could actively do beyond sending ground forces in, but then that is a hugely negative thing which have all sorts of repercussions that we can't predict here and now.
One other thing to mention with the US presidential debate, of course, is that while the Republicans have certainly been making a lot of noise
their debate... there's one individual in the Republican campaign who's making an awful lot of noise.
There's an individual in the Democratic campaign who's been drawing an awfully large crowd. James Boyes, Bernie Sanders was seen as... the ultimate outsider, an old guy who calls himself a socialist and is proud of that, running against Hillary Clinton, the person that everyone in the Democratic Party basically was backing. A lot of these big rallies are in Vermont, and Vermont is pretty liberal. But, there are polls showing him ahead in New Hampshire. How seriously should we take him?
It's very serious. I mean, you were talking about Vermont there. Bernie Sanders is from Vermont, but there was a huge rally in Portland, Oregon this weekend. Drew tens
again,
of
quite
thousands.
Liberal.
Quite liberal. No doubt about it. But, you start putting together, Portland, you move down the coast to San Francisco, Los Angeles, where he's drawing huge crowds. He's drawing bigger crowds than Hillary is, full stop, by multiples.
Is this their Corbyn moment?
It's interesting, isn't it? There's no doubt about it. There is no great love for Hillary Clinton. I hate to say I'm writing a book on her at the moment, so I need her to get the nomination because Hillary Rising won't sell if it doesn't. But there's no doubt that Corbyn is suddenly come out of nowhere. He's outpolling her suddenly in New Hampshire. She's ahead in Iowa. There's no doubt about that at this point. The only thing that's any saving grace for Hillary at the moment, I think, is that despite the fact that she suddenly now seems to be behind in New Hampshire, which is monumentally horrendous, is the fact that nobody, I think, imagines within the Democratic Party, and they are saying this, that Corbyn Bernie Sanders. We'll get the nomination. Everybody expects her to be the nominee, but that's dangerous because if there's an assumption she gets it, people won't feel problematic about voting for someone else because they'll assume everybody else is voting for Hillary, which of course could end up letting in someone else through the back door.
Rafael Pantish, let's steer away from Jeremy Corbyn, who the Bernie Sanders-like figure who seems to be running away with the Labour leadership here at the moment. But if Bernie Sanders was to become, if it was to become a proper two-horse race for the Democratic nomination, do we know what impact that's going to have on Democratic foreign policy? Because so far, that hasn't really been the big issue for him.
I don't think it has. And I think we're just far too far out, frankly, to really have any clear sense of that. Because even if he did win the nomination, one suspects that he would get dragged in a slightly more centrist direction. He'd recruit a bunch of people. You know, he'd have to bring in lots of voices and those would end up starting to look, would start to force him to start to think about some foreign policy questions, some foreign policy decisions. I suspect it would be a much more uninterventious, a much more... I don't know how to put it, really, a sort of different foreign policy to the one that we're seeing now. But I think it'd be very difficult to here and now, 2 years out from the election, be able to predict which direction he would end up going in. You know, these people, once you get into power, especially in a situation like that, you'd have to recruit a whole army of people to work for you. And some of those people would undoubtedly have different perspectives, which would force reality sort of into it.
James, just finally and very, very briefly, Does Bernie Sanders have any actual chance?
No, because the demographic vote is against him. He's going to do well in New Hampshire because he's a favourite son effectively in Vermont. But as soon as you move down towards the Carolinas and the South, the demographics go against him completely and very much for Hillary.
James Boyes, Raffaello Pantucci, thank you both very much for joining us on Midori House. The programme was produced by Daniel Giacopelli. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Elena Nikulacheva. The studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Chris Lord will be here for the next half hour, and then Danny Giacopelli is back at 1900 with the Entrepreneurs. The Monocle Daily is a little bit later. This show, back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 in London, 1300 in New York City. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.